The Dialogue with Clement Manyathela.
It's not just another roundtable discussion.
Let's walk the talk on 702.
On our Thursday dialogue this morning, I want us to discuss Transnet's fees for private companies that want to use its rail network. The company recently published a draft rules for private operators to use South Africa's rail network. This is a key step in the rail reform that has been spoken about even by this current board, because we have a serious logistics crisis in this country and Transnet is at the center of it. This is the largest and most crucial part of the freight logistics chain that delivers goods in South Africa. And Transnet is also the custodian of ports, of rail, of pipelines, but it hasn't been functioning well. And yes, we're beginning to see some positive changes that are leading to some form of stability at Transnet, but it hasn't been functioning well for the longest time. At some point, it was singled out for being a major contributor to slow economic growth. So its inefficiencies have cost the economy. There are some in the industry that say that the economy has actually been affected. So the costing is being put at more than 100 million rand a day, according to some in the industry. Some people are putting it at around 1 billion rand a day. So one of the solutions that the board and the management are setting their eyes on is the reconfiguration of how Transnet operates. In fact, when you look at the board's turnaround plan, it talks a lot to the involvement of the private sector, which means Transnet doesn't operate all its ports. They allow the private sector to take over part of Transnet's over 21,000 kilometer rail network. So you open it up to the private sector so they can participate. But government has to make an offer that is appealing to the private sector so that they can come and invest, because these reforms are going to help increase exports. They're going to help drive economic growth, which is much needed in this country. But government must also not compromise itself in making a deal and reforms that are appealing to the private sector. So we've got stakeholders now that have come up and are raising concerns about the proposed tariffs. You know, they're saying that they are too high. They're saying that Transnet, due to its own financial position, is charging unreasonable high fees, which doesn't make sense because the infrastructure itself is badly maintained. So they believe that the high targets are a result of Transnet's dire financial state. So I want us to have a conversation about what is being proposed. Right? What are these draft rules saying? Are the tariffs feasible at all, or are they unreasonable? Do they work for the private sector? Do they work for the government? How can we make them work for both parties? Because we need a Transnet that works. And how do you make the conditions make sense for the private sector without compromising the state? If you've got some thoughts on this, I'd like you to give us a call on 011-883-0702. The WhatsApp line is 072-702-1702. Let me introduce you to my guests this morning. We've got Professor Jan Havenga, who is the Emeritus Professor at Industrial Engineering at Stellenbosch University, also a director of the GAIN Group. Prof, thank you so much for making time for us. Good morning.
Thank you for the invite. Appreciate it.
We also have Yvette DeRater, who is the Managing Director of Octoro Advisory. It's a consultancy focusing on strategy, rail-based logistics, and digital transformation. Yvette, thank you for also joining us. Good morning.
Good morning, Clement. Thank you very much for the invitation as well.
Basi Mabunda is also joining us. He's the infrastructure manager for rail network and capital projects and has at Transnet and has been serving as general manager for the Transnet Freight Rail for some time now. Basi, I appreciate your time as well. Good morning.
Good morning, Clement. My name is Basi, and not she in this case. And good morning, Everett. Been a while. And good morning to the Prof.
Well, thank you so much, Basi. Let's start with you.
Hi, Basi. Good to hear you again.
Yeah, we'll start with you, Basi, as someone who's coming from Transnet. Just help us understand what these draft rules are saying, because some of the stakeholders are arguing that They are just too high. They're not feasible. From Transnet's point of view, what are the draft rules and how were they determined the way they are now?
Okay, just so that I'm clear, draft rules in terms of the tariff or rules of access in general?
The rules of access.
Okay, all right. In terms of the rules of access, so as Transnet, obviously you will know that there were a number of legal instruments that came out, and in particular, the white paper on rail reform, as well as the EFT bill that is to be signed anytime now. And these basically were very clear in terms of what the role of an infrastructure manager will be. So there's a lot that's contained in this legal instrument that basically directs how, as an infrastructure manager, we are supposed to organize ourselves and what it actually means to open access. We've also taken the responsibility on ourselves to actually benchmark quite significantly internationally to understand how other railways that have gone through the journey that we are expected to go through have actually taken up this kind of a challenge and have successfully opened up access to third parties. So the access conditions and the rules that are being put forward in the network state, the draft network statement that we have actually published, are not things that are just made up. These are things that are aligned to the legal, to the regulatory instruments that have come up, but that have also been benchmarked quite a lot globally. So basically, from an IM point of view, we have a responsibility to ensure that there is non-discriminatory access to the rail network. That means same access for whether it is the TFR operating company or if it's a private sector train operating company which is seeking access on our network. The basic things that everyone needs to basically comply with, and you'll appreciate that these are actually reasonable requirements, is number one, they need to demonstrate that they are able to actually run train services on the network, because there's no point in giving access and having access being held by somebody who does not have the requisite rolling stock in order to safely operate trains on our network. There's a lot of requirements around the rolling stock itself, technically, that they must be compliant with the various parts of the network and all the technical specifications of the network. And that is critical, even from a rail safety compliance point of view, for the safe running of trains. So that is critical. One, the other aspect that is critical is that these entities need to have train drivers and train crew that is trained and certified and have the requisite road or route knowledge in terms of being able to safely operate the trains on our network. So that is quite critical. The other things is obviously they need to have an operating permit, which is issued by the rail safety regulator. As ourselves, as Transnet, we ourselves also have an operating permit issued by the RSR. So that's a safety requirement, and that is a must that must actually be in place. So those are the, you know, the key requirements for access.
Okay. And in terms of, will you be charging in terms of the costing for the private sector coming and taking over some of the rail?
Okay, so at this point in time, what we are looking to do with open access, as I indicated, is just to allow non-discriminatory access into the rail network, so we do not have a monopoly in terms of train operations. So currently, we obviously have a monopoly in Transnet Freight Rail that is both operating the rail infrastructure, but also then running train services. What we're doing is we are doing a vertical separation of TFR, where we will then end up with the network business being the infrastructure manager and then the operations business that will then run the trains. The operations business will then compete on the same footing with incoming train operating companies that will then be given access through this process onto their rail network in order to run their own trains. In terms of investment into the network, the current approach that we've taken to start off with, we cannot at this point in time anticipate how much investment, for example, will come in from private sector and into which parts of the network. So what we've done is we have approached it and done a tariff methodology that assumes at the onset that the IM is fully accountable for the entire network in terms of ensuring that it is maintained to the right standard, to ensure that the network is reliable and available and safe for the running of trains. So we've then approached it in that way. That then means that we've provided a methodology that ensures that the IM is able to recover all operating costs, that the IM have sufficient funding in order to invest in the network, to restore it to the level that it should be in, but also to then be able to invest for ongoing maintenance of the network. Okay. If at any point in time a private sector is interested in investing in any part of the line, whether it is to restore capacity that has been lost over time or to unlock new capacity, there is discussions there that is slightly different from open access around how then do we then allow private sector to then invest, what kind of transaction that will mean from a PSP point of view, what benefits will accrue to the investor. Okay. The investor, a train operating company themselves, would they like a longer term in terms of being able to have slots so that they can run their trains? Would we then be looking at maybe some sort of a tariff rebate in terms of the level of tariffing that we give them? Or is the investor someone who just wants to invest and would like some other type of benefit to accrue to them? So that will all depend on who then approaches us to actually invest on the network.
All right, Professor Havenga, your thoughts on these proposed network tariffs, but also on the draft rules?
Yes, I think without a doubt, and one can have a long discussion about it, that the tariffs are probably more than double as what they should be. That is a flat, sort of a flat statement. And one have to understand why. And it's important for me to just take a minute or two and explain why I think it's too high. We're talking here about the railway network that's been completely destroyed by previous management and by the shareholder itself. The shareholder itself, you and I are shareholders, but I mean the government being our representative shareholder, has basically caused the hole in the balance sheet of Transnet to the tune of 70, 80 billion. They've got a debt of 140 billion, but I mean half of that debt, they've got nothing for. Imagine a company that's bought something for 70 billion rand and got absolutely nothing for it. And that is state capture. So that state capture debt sits on the balance sheet. Because of that, the railway went into the death spiral of not doing maintenance and going to a point now where the network is really in a very, very bad condition. And there's this is no secret. Last week in a press conference, the chair of Transnet has actually shared some very specific details about this. So we know the network's in a very bad condition. So Transnet's got high debt, bad condition network, was poorly managed for a long period of time, including the time of state capture and the management that followed that. The last year saw fantastic improvements, wonderful improvements, both from the government side, that through the freight logistics roadmap, basically started the reform process, which this is part of. This is indicated in the roadmap. Also by appointing a great new leadership at Transnet. I've got the utmost respect and faith in the chair, in the new chief executive of Transnet. Michelle Phillips is a brilliant person. The chief executive of the railway, Russell Baitis, is a fantastic leader. He can lead a railway anywhere in the world. But we now sit with this problem of the network that's completely shot. They've improved rail operations a lot over the last few months, and they've done fantastic work. But right now, they're forced to issue statement and charge a tariff that cannot be afforded. It's completely impossible to afford. And a shareholder that caused a lot of these problems will have to step up now. Take over some of that debt that shouldn't be on the balance sheet. Pay for some of the maintenance that was never mm-hmm. done. Mm-hmm. That we can get to sort of an equal point. And then we can calculate a tariff that's much more fair. So I've got no problem with the network statement. And I've got no problem Transnet saying, well, if nobody's going to help us, this is what we'll have to charge. But the company, the country cannot pay it. It has to be more than 50% less.
What is the minimum access service fee that is being proposed?
As far as I know, it's around about 20 cents per gross ton kilometer. Mm-hmm. And for the first period, it includes electricity. After a while, that will go away, which in a certain sense is also unfair. because if you're a diesel operator, you're going to pay somewhat for electricity as well. But the 20 cents is far too much. I can give it to you in a different way. If you were to charge the same access charge to an interlink truck leaving Johannesburg going to Cape Town, it will pay 17,500 rand for the trip. Currently, it pays about 4,000 rand, which is the combination of the fuel levy, the fuel levy and the toll fees and the license fees. So this is our road to rail strategy in South Africa in a nutshell. The truck gets the N1 that works very well for 4,000 rand. The rail operator gets a railway for 17,000 rand for the same job. So It just doesn't work and it's too high.
Okay. Evert, your thoughts?
Unfortunately, not disagreeing with Dr. Ovenhoe at all. I think he's raised a couple of really important points. I think that the challenge that we've got, and as a former employee of Transnet, I will say that we've been watching this process of railway reform for a long time. And I guess the unlocking the potential of our economy, Dr. Ovenhoe is actually the author, him and his team, is the author of the claim of R1 billion a day impact on the economy. Mm. And that cost is hardly felt by the man on the street in terms of day-to-day experience. If there's load shedding, lights go off, they feel it. The creeping cost of the cost of goods and businesses going out of business. I mean, if we think about the mining industry is losing, I think in the range of about 30,000 jobs a quarter, creating extreme vulnerability around the industrialized component and resources component of our economy. We have to find a way for Transnet to play a meaningful role in the future of our railway system post-reform, which is to reduce the cost of logistics. That was always Transnet's mandate under the monopolistic conditions. Now with railway reform, we're expecting to see a liberalization. Unfortunately, before we get to the cost component, the way that the current network state is talking and the way that the freight logistics roadmap is describing the process, we've just rebranded the monopoly. The monopoly is around the network access, and the network access is to the access charges that we're talking about, but the network access should also be liberalized as was intended by the white paper. Now, the white paper is quite often poo-pooed as just a document. It's not. It's actually a policy document approved by cabinet and therefore should be adhered to quite strictly. At this stage, the FLR, Freight Logistics Roadmap, isn't fully following what the white paper had intended, and we still have this entity called TRIM that is both asset owner and infrastructure manager. The intention of the white paper was to actually separate that. That position is not necessarily always popular, but it is what the original intent was. Now, it could be done over a longer period of time. The problem is, as Dr. Hovenhoe explained, is that you have this legacy debt that's now resting on Bessie's shoulders and her team, that nobody wants to bail them out, and they've got to find a way to cover in excess of about 30, 40 billion rands of debt just accruing to them. They've got to do significant upgrades. Now, in its current structure, there isn't a direct path for infrastructure investment by the private sector. In fact, the current structure precludes it because you'll have to invest in a government entity, a state-owned entity called TRIM. And if the current figures, and I speak on a correction, I'm looking at Dr. Jan to perhaps help me out if my figures aren't exactly accurate, but the current cost structure, different way, as he's already done elegantly, the future TRIM will have a turnover expected to be higher than that of the whole of TFR today. And that's within the next 12 months. Mm. So that cost is unbearable. We cannot bear that inefficiency in our network. But as I said, if I look at what the Transnet guys are doing with no investment path into infrastructure, they've got to carry that on their own. They also have it on too large a network. We don't need 22,000 kilometers of network maintained to a top level. So if we can shrink the network, we can split the asset owner and the infrastructure manager as was intended, and we can get some kind of efficiency in terms of the tariff, we probably have a way forward. What I'm really excited about, though, is that we have this process is currently being overseen by IREC. I apologize for I'm not going to remember the full acronym, but it's the interim regulator, if you will. reporting to the Department of Transport. They're facilitating public consultation. So I do believe we're going to get some really constructive inputs.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think we're in a journey. But the future changed railway system in South Africa will have Transnet as a very, very important player. They've got 1,800 to 2,000 locomotives that they will still have to run. We hopefully will see more liberalized infrastructure management with there's an estimate during the rounds of between 200 and 250 billion rands of private sector investment that is waiting to be unlocked. But we've got to create the conditions for that to succeed. If we don't do that, and if we barrel down this path and put all the pressure on Transnet and all their various components, we're going to struggle, and our economy can't afford it.
Bessie, I want to give you an opportunity to respond to some of what Jan and Evett have had to say. But I suppose the question I have is, did you as Transnet come up with the tariffs based on the balance sheet as it is? And are you open to negotiations on these proposed access fees? Is there perhaps even a conversation about Transnet taking over this heavy legacy of debt?
Hey, thanks. I'm going to cover your question last. I'm just going to go back and respond to some of the comments that have been made. So just to go back to the prof, I know the prof spoke at length about the state capture, the high debt levels, failure of management, and so on. But I think we're failing to appreciate some key things and key challenges that the organization has had to face. And it's important to understand that, for one, in any country that has gone through rail reform and they've gone through the process of open access, in all of the countries that we have benchmarked, there has been state support for the process. So if you look at it, for example, in the EU and in the UK, in the UK, the state is subsidizing about 70% of the cost of the infrastructure manager. In Germany, for example, they are subsidizing 60% of the cost. There are other smaller countries in the EU, for example, like Latvia, Estonia, and so on, where they're even going so far as to actually fully subsidize the infrastructure manager. And then where you've got the lowest levels of subsidization is in countries like your Sweden and Netherlands, where it's like about 10% or so. So there has been no country that goes through this process, and especially at the onset, is expected that the infrastructure manager should bear the full burden of the cost of providing a safe, reliable, and available rail network to the country. So I think that's important to put out there. The second thing is that we are also not talking about another big challenge that we have faced, and not only just ourselves, is the Transnet, Prasa, and other infrastructure companies in the country have suffered, and that is the security issues, the rate of theft and vandalism to infrastructure. That has been something that we have had to deal with, and a lot of money that is meant to go to normal maintenance and restoration of the network ends up getting channeled into repairing damage and repairing and restoring lines that have actually been stolen through theft and vandalism. I mean, we appreciate the National Logistic Crisis Center that has been established, where with partnership with government as well as private sector, we are coming together to look at solutions for some of these things. That is definitely something that is much appreciated. But we cannot not mention things like that as part of the challenges that we have. Some of the things that Jan mentioned, and I agree with him 100%, is the issue around the shareholders stepping up and taking some of the challenges. And I will cover that a little bit later, you know, as I wrap up to answer your question, Clement. Evett, in terms of what you spoke about, that Transnet has a responsibility to reduce the cost of logistics. I think it's important that we understand and accept that a single entity will not be able to take on such a challenge on its own without support from private sector, without support from the state. This is a problem that needs to be dealt with by multiple stakeholders that together can find solutions to the challenges that are being faced. So that is important, that we're not left as in Transnet, this is your responsibility. And I think that is why we end up in the situation that we are in. Historically, there was a lot of developmental mandate that was put on Transnet to support certain industry, whether we're talking automotives, the agricultural sector, and so on, in order to have tariffs that are low enough to attract them from road onto rail. Mm-hmm. That unfortunately has led to a situation where the tariffs that are being charged to these sectors is not even cost reflective. So we actually move those volumes at a loss. So these are things that if it's left to just an entity to fully be accountable to reduce the cost of logistics for our country, we are going to fail. It takes more than just an entity.
Yeah. I've got a follow-up there, and I want to give you an opportunity to finish off that response, Bessie, but I want to take the latest in Eyewitness News headlines first because I'm a bit late. It's 11:32.
The Dialogue with Clement Maniatela.
It's not just another roundtable discussion.
Let's walk the talk on 7:02.
It's 22 minutes before 12 o'clock. It's a conversation on our Thursday Dialogue this morning about Transnet's fees for private companies that want to use its rail network. We've discussed the draft rules. We've also spoken about the proposed minimum access service fees. We've heard what the concerns are around that. And Bessie, I just want to give you an opportunity to conclude your response. The follow-up question I had, because you spoke about a collective approach here, because you're saying a single entity cannot take on this challenge alone. So the private sector has got to play a role, and so does the shareholder. What are you expecting then from the private sector, and what role can the shareholder play? Is part of the consideration that they can take over this dead burden?
Okay, thanks. Okay, so just to continue, and I guess it will also cover what you're highlighting now, is Evett mentioned the issue of the size of the network, and that is something that we've had to look at, because our network by world standards is actually quite large. Our just over 21,000 route kilometers is actually quite a significant network. So we have looked at it, and we have done tiering, what we call tiering of the network and classification of the network. And we've basically identified that is about 12,300 of what we view as a commercial network where there is a lot of traffic on, and there's about 8,900 or so kilometers that is low density, more branch lines. And the instruments that we spoke about, the regulatory instruments that we spoke about earlier, do mention branch line strategy being something that the government needs to have conversations with us about. So right now, because we have not yet reached fruition in terms of this discussion, the branch lines is part of the calculation of the tariff. So if the branch lines, if this 8,900 kilometers is removed, it will then remove some of the costing from the IM and reduce the tariff. So that is something that the government could then support us with once they have finalized the branch line strategy. With regards to the tariff itself, in terms of how we came about it and what it looks like and room for negotiation. So basically, we've used a global best practice tariff methodology, which is a required revenue methodology. This is a methodology that is used by other railways around the world, but more so, it is a methodology that is known even in our own country. So it is used in the energy sector, for example, by Eskom. It is used in pipelines and ports in our own space, in Transnet. But it's also used in the aviation space by EXA. So this is not a methodology that is unknown. Basically, what this methodology has, it comprises of four components. The first component being what is called the return on assets. So having calculated what our asset base is, we then expect the return on those assets. So the return on those assets, what it's actually used for, it provides investment into the capital that's required to restore the network and even deal with the maintenance backlog that we have. It also affords us the ability to repay the current debt that we have and any finance charges that is related to that. The second component is it covers operating costs. Operating costs, obviously, is like personnel, as well as security costs that we spoke about, electricity. And I think Evett mentioned the cost of electricity. Just for interest sake, the electricity cost as part of the operating cost, it accounts for a third of those costs. So that's quite significant. And yes, we understand that there is a need at some point to start looking at the variable electricity cost elements so that we actually charge the users that will then be using electrical traction versus those that will be using diesel traction. But that is something that will then be introduced down the line. The third bucket is depreciation. The depreciation is important because what depreciation allows us to do is the ongoing routine maintenance. It actually funds that. And then, of course, provision for tax. So those are the building blocks of our current required revenue methodology as we have it. The IREC, which is the Inter-Rail Economic Regulator Capacity, has been charged with the responsibility of assisting in finalizing the process of the network statement as well as the tariff. So there is the public consultation process that is ongoing. They are consulting with all stakeholders, and they will make a determination and put forward a recommendation to the ministers around what the network statement should look like and what the final tariff should be. So there is some room in terms of discussions and some level of negotiation. But what is important, and I have to state this, I think it's important that everyone needs to understand that the network requires what the network requires. If we are expecting that in a few short years, a year or two down the line, we have a reliable network, we have an available network, we have a safe network that can support industries to the level that we require it to, the network requires to be funded at the right level. The only question is that, is there room for other parties to come in to support, to then remove some of the financial pressures?
Is the appetite, though, I just want to bring in Jan in a moment, but is there appetite from government to help in bridging and helping with that funding?
Okay, so at this point in time, what we have to our advantage is that the regulatory instruments state very clearly that government will take part in terms of ensuring that the IM is fully funded. So they commit to that. So from a regulatory point of view, that is something that is already stated. There's already a statement in those legal instruments, in those regulatory instruments as well, around the participation of private sector in funding through various mechanisms, whether it is through concessions, whether it's through a capacity upgrades, whether it's even what we call maintenance concession, where they can fund ongoing maintenance on particular lines, and different ways in which private sector can get involved. So that is also a mechanism that will then help support.
Okay, Jan.
I'll talk quickly because I want Evert to have an opportunity as well. Just I agree with basically 100% about state subsidy. It is quite normal. And in fact, in South Africa, it's quite calculable. If I compare the subsidy received by Sunrail and the railway does the work that it should do, I can actually calculate what that subsidy should be. It should be in the region of about 20 billion per annum. If you want a well-functioning railway, that is what the government should pay if it pays the same for the effort that it pays Sunrail. So that's point number one. Point number two, I understand BC's tariff calculation methodology, but at the same time, if you benchmark this around the world, most governments around the world do not ask for a return on asset. That's usually not included. So often depreciation is not even included. So the return on asset shouldn't be there, which is another way of saying the debt should be written off or taken away from that whole process. And thirdly, and I think Evert can talk about the splitting of the ownership of the infrastructure and the operating of the infrastructure will create much more opportunities for private sector funding and will allow us to have a better or a leaner infrastructure manager for that case.
Okay. And as you come in here, because ultimately what Transnet needs to think about is how do we make an offer that is one, realistic, but that is also going to make it cost-effective and attractive alternative to road freight. When you look at this, fundamentally, does it say to the private sector, actually, move from the road, come to rail? Is it attractive enough?
Clement, absolutely not, unfortunately. This is the, we're observing the most effective rail-to-road strategy known to man. We've got coal on the roads, we've got iron on the roads, we've got chrome on the roads. All those things should be on rail. Yes, there's a capacity issue currently, and it is predominantly driven by network conditions. I feel for the pain that Bessie is expected to solve on her own. But at the end of the day, there's the problem that we have at the moment is what Jan was referring to, is we don't have a structure whereby the private sector can take a meaningful role as was envisaged by the white paper. In fact, the white paper was quite clear about the fact that the state will not take sole responsibility for infrastructure investment. In fact, that's a common misconception that the state assumed that. The state actually said it in a number of cases, and obviously the person to go to on this one is man looking after the checkbook, Minister Gordon Gwana. He said the issue is to fix South Africa's logistics issues, not necessarily to fix Transnet. So the lesson we learned from Eskom, we've got to reform the whole sector rather than that of the single entity. So for me, the drive, and I fully support what Bessie is saying as well. Maybe we interpret it differently. We don't want, as a private sector, and I'm not speaking on their behalf, I'm just active in the sector. The private sector wants to play a meaningful role in rail in South Africa in its future, as was envisaged by the white paper. That includes train operating companies alongside Transnet Freight Rail Operating Company, infrastructure management alongside TRIM, and an asset owner separate from Transnet, as is currently the case with SANRAL. SANRAL is effectively, for a large part of the operations, is the land asset owner for the infrastructure, and they have operating companies such as the N3 Toll Company, Bakwena, etc., that run these on their behalf. And the access charges are akin to toll fees. I think maybe to close out, if I look at, and I know Bessie and them, obviously we had line of sight of some of the benchmarks that were done from the earliest days. One of the popular examples is Deutsche Bahn in Germany. Now, Deutsche Bahn is a very specific case, and to be clear about it, yes, it's a very large railway. It did follow a massive model of state support. But the problem that we've got is one that's been highlighted by a lot of research that says state-owned infrastructure owners invariably just keep recovering costs to pay their current footprint, but they leave and they transfer costs of replacement or maintenance to the next generation of taxpayers or users. And we're seeing that. That's OECD research that was done and published. We're seeing it. There was an article last year about the state of Deutsche Bahn today. And Deutsche Bahn is in severe financial distress, and government will have to bail them out. What we're advocating for, and we really want to work with Transnet along this, is to say we've got to find a way to meaningfully introduce the private sector into the system. Currently, a lot of credence is given to a document that's referred to as the PSP framework. It is, in fact, only a PSP, a report on a PSP framework. And the items that Bessie mentioned in terms of concessions, in terms of maintenance and things like that, those are all just preliminary items. The true concern is an infrastructure management commission with multiple players, including Transnet, providing the rolling stock on that. Now, that vertical separation is the term that's used, is very different. And a lot of people jump to the conclusion that it failed in Britain, hence it will fail here. And there's a lot of resistance around this. But I will say, maybe we can debate this at a future stage. I think our white paper on railway reform is very unique and very suitable to South Africa. It's very liberal. It has really exciting ideas in it, although it's not perfect. It really is an exciting policy that can unlock tons and tons of money. And exactly the money that Bessie is talking about, we fully understand that problem. We think the network repair costs is obscene, but we've got to find a way to create an investment path for the private sector to participate alongside government entities. And if you look at the network tiering, in fact, the network tiering that was included in the Freight Logistics Roadmap was done by the GAIN group, of which Jan is a key member. That network tiering says that we have a significant part of our network that is commercially viable for infrastructure managers to participate. And that means that we've got to move away from the legacy stress that's placed on just purely the state to do all of this. Private sector is ready to participate. Just create the environment for them to succeed. Yeah. They'll succeed alongside Transnet.
Bessie, if these issues are resolved, the necessary funding is there, you are able to bridge the gap, and you've got this assistance both from the shareholder and the private sector. What difference are we going to see? In other words, what impact is this approach of bringing in the new private players into the rail and the ports are going to make in just the broader management and functioning of Transnet?
Yeah, thanks. So I can only speak on behalf of the IM, not the broader Transnet. I wish I could, but I can't. If we do receive the level of funding that the network actually requires, the things that we're going to feel on a tangible basis are actually a network that is able to move the volumes that we have last seen probably in 2016, so to the levels of about 226 million tons. And in fact, in a few short years, in about 2 to 3 years, we could be able to then even move that to what the system currently is capable of doing, which is in the level of about 243 million tons, which is quite significant. So the kind of support from a logistic point of view that this will provide is quite significant. But more than that, you'll also then be experiencing a network that is available and reliable. So not one that is burdened with delays, stops and starts, but also that requires not only investment, as I've said, it also requires solving the serious theft and vandalism that we have. But with the partnerships that we have with the NLCC and the correct level of investment, restoring the network to the levels that it needs to be, maintaining the network to the levels that it should be maintained on an ongoing basis, we should experience an efficient, effective, and available rail network system that will really go a long way in ensuring that from a logistic point of view, it supports our country. So those are the things that we can feel. But I think also one of the things that is also important is that because the system has been in crisis, we've also not been able to leverage on technological advancements that are there that will allow us to even breach the 243 million tons that I'm talking about. The system could do a lot more with the latest technologies that are out there from a rail point of view. But those are things that are difficult to implement where you have a system that is in crisis, a system that is forever being inundated with theft and vandalism. You cannot put anything new. You put it in today, tomorrow it is gone. So over time, if we get this right, the logistics from a rail, freight rail point of view will really be at a level that is more efficient and more effective and will definitely contribute tremendously to the economic growth of the country.
Yeah. And Jan, in your assessment, because also the private sector has been impacted and of course our economy as well, when Transnet is not functioning the way that it should, if all these things are resolved, what difference are we going to see?
It will make a massive difference. Number one, I can tell you right now, we can add the economic growth 3 to 5% annually to our GDP if we can do these things right. And I think to solve that problem of R1 billion a day that we lose in the economy at the moment because of what we're not being able to do on rail, to solve that step will be required. I think government, by appointing new leadership at Transnet, and doing a few things differently, the NLCC becoming involved, starting this process, is actually giving us hope, and it's doing things, pushing things in the right direction. But the breakthrough that is required now is the understanding that we'll have to take that debt away from this problem. Number one, it has to be done.
Yeah.
And number two, we'll have to start a discussion of a small subsidy to the infrastructure manager. I agree with that. And number three, critically important, we have to make the infrastructure management process itself accessible to the private sector by splitting infrastructure management and infrastructure ownership.
All right. Unfortunately, we are out of time. Let me think. All of you for making time for us this morning, Professor Jan Havenga, Yvette Dereita, and Bessie Mabunda.